Hello, everyone, and welcome to the On the Ledge podcast. I am your host, as always, Rylan Johnson. Today's guest, I'm very excited and happy that he agreed to do this, is none other than our MP, Michael McLeod. I don't have a lot of nice things to say about the Liberal Party traditionally or about our current Prime Minister, but I have absolutely nothing bad to say about our MP. And I think everything that he talks about in this episode is a prime example of why. Every time I have had to deal with our MP, both as an MLA or a citizen, it has been outstanding service. I'm proud to have Michael McLeod as our representative in Ottawa. This episode, for the first about 20 minutes, I just let Michael talk. And I remember thinking as he was talking whether I should interrupt him, whether this is good interviewing technique. But as a seasoned expert, I really feel that Michael McLeod knows how to tell his story. And really, as an interviewer, there's not much I had to do in this episode. He has thought about these issues and he gives really great answers. And eventually we cover all of the topics and in a somewhat linear fashion. And I hope it colors a bit more experience for all of our listeners about, how fortunate we are to have MP McLeod representing us in Ottawa. And, perhaps gives a picture of him that we sometimes forget. And a picture that I think party politics and the partisanship and the media coverage can kind of make irrelevant or wash down what's happening in Ottawa. But ultimately, the character of the people we send to parliamentary offices is of the utmost importance. And I just would like to thank MP McLeod for doing it. So without further ado, let's get it started. Thanks for listening. Good morning, MP McLeod. Welcome to the On the Ledge podcast. Firstly, I just want to thank you for doing this.
And good morning to you, and thank you for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we've both been, endless Zoom meetings. So as pandemic governance has gone, it's just one Zoom meeting after another. So I appreciate you, stepping into one more. Hopefully we can, this could be a little funner than some of our usual committee business and whatnot. I guess I want to eventually talk about, life in Ottawa and kind of what, you've been in almost 7 years now in Ottawa, and any advice or kind of thoughts you'd impart. But before we even do that, I think the listenership of this podcast, I always picture it as being my dad, someone who's not too political and doesn't necessarily no issues too much. So that is who we're speaking to as an intended audience, perhaps not a bunch of political wonks. And in order to do that, I'd like to kind of, I've heard you speak previously about, growing up in Fort Providence and having three languages spoken in your household and kind of the role that your parents and your large family played in your path to politics. So I guess maybe we could start with you just describing, some of the influences that your life in Fort Providence you brought into politics and kind of how they have led you to where you are today.
Okay. I was born in a log house, log cabin on the banks of the Mackenzie River. During a time when the community was very small. There was the mission with all their buildings and the Hudson Bay store, the RCMP, and maybe a dozen houses in the community. And we lived in our small house, all of us. There was eight children and my mom and dad. And for the most part, we all spoke the Mi'kmaq language. That was the language at home. And my parents also spoke the Dene language of the area. And of course, they spoke English. I didn't speak English until I started school at 6 years old. And I can remember the day, the first day I went to school, because it was terrifying for me. I couldn't speak English, and it was a building I'd never been in, and there was lots of students that I'd never met, and so it was a tough time adjusting to the school, but I managed, and the community continued to grow. It went from us having to haul water for drinking water and cooking and everything else from the river. In the wintertime, we'd haul ice and firewood for our stove. And the one thing that stayed with me is that it was always cold in our house. At night, the fire would go out, and when we'd get up to go to school in the morning, everything would be frozen. We'd have to light the wood stove and haul wood in, and a lot of times you'd have to go to the bathroom at night. You had to use the outhouse, and when it's 30, 40 below, it's not a pleasant experience. So those things I remember. And when I was 10 years old, the government started building houses in the community, and we were selected to be allocated a unit, one of the low cost housing units. My dad had some property that he sold, so we could have all brand new furniture, new beds, new couches. And when we moved in, it was such a change. It was like we won the lottery, because the house was nice and warm. It had a furnace. We didn't have to haul wood. We didn't have to haul water. And we each had our own rooms. It was so great. And during those times, my dad was involved with the community through what was called the community club, because there was no political organizations at that time. And they organized events, they organized carnivals, they looked after the community hall, and they ran the movies, and they made decisions about the community. And he also did a lot of volunteering for people that couldn't read or write, and there was quite a few people that were in that situation in those days. So he did their income tax returns, and he would write letters for them. And he started getting me involved. And I was doing income tax returns with him, under his guidance, of course, when I was quite young. And I also started helping him with the movie nights. And so I was probably 12, 13 years old, and I was running the movies for the community, and have make sure there was somebody to run a projector and collect money at the door and pay for the movies and file the financial statements. And so I was learning quite a bit from him, and learning the ropes of how to get things done. And at the school, by that time, in my early teens, we decided that we should have a student council, and I was elected as the president of the student council. So I started, I guess, on the road of politics at that time, and I was learning all throughout that process that excuse me that if you were involved, and if you work towards something, it could happen. And from the school here in the community, I then was sent out to Cato Hall, the hostel in Yellowknife, to continue my schooling at high school level. And I also got involved in politics, or the politics of the hostel there. I got elected to the Board of Governors as a student representative. And so I was quite involved in decision-making up to a certain point. And I was really interested in the process, and I was really keen to see things change and get better. And so when I left the Kitchell Hall, I went to work for the Métis Nation. And they were quite involved in land claims. And I got quite an education on land claims and governance and all those issues that were hot and in the news all the time. And when I finished that job with them, I came back to the community and I started working as the band manager. I got hired as a band manager, as a trainee, and I really got an education mostly through making a lot of mistakes and really trying to learn the ropes, because I didn't have a lot of guidance. The guy that was supposed to train me after 6 months said, I think you're doing good. I think you don't need to have me around. And the only thing I had under my belt was 1 year of business management training. And so I had some education, but not a lot of experience. So we did a lot of things that maybe somebody with a lot more experience wouldn't have done, but we took a lot of chances and we did a lot of good things. And I'm very proud of those days that I worked with the Fort Providence Standing Council and the number of programs that we got off the ground and number of people we helped. And I think it really provided me with the experience and provided me with education through the meetings that I attended on what people were really concerned about and what they wanted to see. You know, I got to hear all the elders of the day, what they talked about, and it was really informative and it was really good for me to hear. It really grounded me and it gave me a solid base, I think. I was being invited to the tribal council meetings quite a bit because I was probably one of the few younger people that was involved, and the elders liked it because I spoke English and I could read and write, and I wasn't afraid to speak up. Although my issues were not the same as what the elders were at the table were talking about. They were talking about land claims and self-government and the environment. I was talking about things that concerned me as a younger individual. I was talking about sports facilities and games and, you know, recreation activities. And it didn't always sit well with some of the leaders, but fortunately, the older leaders that were there, the elders that were there, would always caution and remind the chiefs that younger people needed to be heard and we need to hear what they're thinking. So it was good. It was a good education for me. And I also started doing some business on the side. I started contracting with a company that I set up, and I was a busy guy. I was working as a band manager. I ran for the position of mayor. I got elected. I think I was 22 years old when I became the mayor. And I was also contracting. I bought some equipment and just did some small contracts around the community and stayed very busy and also stayed involved with the going ons with in the community. I was a founding member for the Friendship Center, for example. I did a lot of work on getting that set up. I did the constitution and bylaws and put it all together and chased the money around and lobbied the National Association to include us. And we finally got funding, and the Friendship Center is running to this day. It's a good program. And we also set up the development corporation here in the community called Diga Enterprises. And it's over 30 years now that the that they've been operating, and they've created a lot of employment, and they keep a good solid economic foundation for the indigenous governments, both the Banan and the Métis here. So I was quite active, and over the years I had been approached by many people to run for the position of MLA for the Legislative Assembly. And I had hesitated for quite a few years because my goal was still to go to college, go to university, and get my degree in commerce. And that's what I had been working towards. I had really intended to do that. So I kept putting off any commitments to try to get involved in the politics at the territorial level. But finally, after shooting my mouth off and being critical for quite some time, I decided, well, I got to either shut up or else do something. So I decided that I would try to do one term. And I ran, and I got elected, and I ended up doing 12 years, three terms at the territorial government level. And it was, again, a good experience. I ended up on cabinet, and I worked hard and stayed quite busy. And on my fourth term, I ended up losing the election to Michael Natley. It was a fairly close election. We ran against each other a couple times, and this time he managed to get the support. And so I stepped away from politics and did other things. Also made some real personal lifestyle changes. I really was at a point where I wanted to live healthier. And I wanted to be a better father, a better husband. And I decided that alcohol wasn't doing me any good. It was actually creating a lot of problems. So I had some soul searching to do, and decided that I would quit drinking, quit the alcohol. And it made a real difference in my life. It changed my life around, and it made things a lot more positive. And I think it made my family happier, and I saw the benefit that it provided to many of my relatives that saw the lifestyle change and how much impact it made on me, and they decided to also walk away from alcohol, and it made me feel good. I really, I'm happy I made that decision, and I wish I had done it sooner, of course, but it didn't work out that way, and I did it when I was, I think, feeling like I was doing it by myself for a while, but then when the other people start also quitting and that were close to me, it really was good. And then I started being approached by quite a few people from across the territories to consider running for the member of parliament position.
Yeah, and how long was there between you not being a cabinet minister and then running for MP? How long was that time period?
Well, it was around 4 years.
Yeah, yeah, you just couldn't get out, eh?
Yeah, I was quite busy. I was quite content in what I was doing. I was doing a lot of different things during those 4 years that I had been away from the minister's position. I was working on, I was working with some territorial boards. And I really enjoyed that work. I was also working for the Government of the Territories as a parks officer and tourism officer. And it was interesting work also. And I was helping people out on a consulting kind of basis. I was negotiating agreements for some of the indigenous governments. I was setting up contracts with companies for them. And so I was very busy, and you know, it was good work. It was interesting, and it was what I wanted to do. And but at the same time, my phone was ringing and people were saying, there's an election coming up, you should consider it. And I really had to consider, you know, really had to do a lot of thinking about it. I had to talk to a lot of people, because I had just worked for 12 years in the government of Northwest Territories, and it was hard work. And you know, I didn't know I wanted to walk back into that type of an arena, but some of my volunteer work kind of convinced me. I was working with the youth, with the junior rangers. I saw, you know, the need for a good future with them. I was also in martial arts, so I was a student in martial arts. So it was eye-opening to talk to all these young kids. I was the oldest guy there. It was mostly young kids and me and the instructor. So I got to spend a lot of time with the young kids. And it finally, I was convinced in my mind that I had to do whatever I could. I had to offer whatever education experience and to a better future for these young people. So I put my name in, I ran, and I got elected. And I'm now on my third term as the Member of Parliament for Northwest Territories.
Yeah, I'd like to hear you speak about, I mean, because my understanding is it's not like you were an active member of a party or, you know, following Ottawa politics all that closely. Your kind of first day when you get to the Hill, and especially after years of consensus government, what kind of surprised you about, you know, showing up in Ottawa and how that operated?
I had never belonged to a political party. I had been asked by a number of different parties to join them. And in fact, I had been asked by at least one other party to consider running under their banner. But it wasn't something that I was totally interested in. I had the opportunity was also open for me to run again as the MLA. But I felt that we needed somebody that had experience at territorial government level to work with the government Northwest Territories, to work with the municipalities, to work with the indigenous governments. And I had experience in every one of those areas. I had just been a cabinet minister. I had been an indigenous leader. I'd been, you know, the president of our Métis local, and I had been a mayor, so I was familiar with the municipalities and their processes that they went through. So, you know, I brought that to the table. And so the transition in that sense wasn't that difficult. I was able to get good staff right away, staff that, you know, I knew were going to be loyal, and I knew were very capable and educated and familiar with the North. But it still was kind of shocking to see the level of noise that comes from the floor of the House. I didn't expect it to be as disrespectful as it gets. It gets to the point where you can't really hear what's going on. And, you know, somebody's trying to talk and people are yelling and screaming at them. And it seems sometimes that the speaker is really challenged to control it.
Yeah, I would say the worst day in consensus government's question period would probably be the best day in the history of Commons history.
Well, you know, I had gone, I had been in the trenches learning about how to work in the communities with the different councils. You know, I was involved in all levels of governance at the community level, municipal, indigenous, and I also had been involved at territorial government level. And it was totally different when I went to Ottawa, because in consensus government, you need to create alliances. You need to be able to make your case to convince people to support you. And and everybody seems to work towards what's in the best interest. You know, we have a lot of good people running for political positions, whether it's a municipal or indigenous governments or territorial government, with good intentions. And when they get there, they try to convince everybody else that the solution that they have is a good one. But when you get to the party politics level, it's a different game altogether. It's loud. It's about crushing your opponent. It's disrespectful, in my opinion. And it's about party survival. And I was fortunate because I came there with enough experience, enough life experience, enough political experience to know that I had to hit the ground running and start working on the agenda I had, the vision that I came there with, and that was to make change for people in Northwest Territory. So I was busy right from the get-go, talking to ministers, meeting with staff, you know, lobbying people to understand where I was coming from. But at the same time, on the floor of the house, there was so much yelling and people in confrontation that it kind of made me shake my head quite a few times. And I ended up, you know, getting to know a lot of the members of Parliament from the different parties, from the Conservative side, from the Bloc, from the NDP, the Greens. And a lot of them now are quite good friends of mine. But at the same time, if we have a good idea, or if they have a good idea, because of the party practice, we don't seem to want to be able, we can't seem to work together. The members could say it's a really good idea. I'd love to see that happen, but I can't support you. You know, and that doesn't make sense to me because of my background. And it should change. It should be based on what's best for the country and best for the people rather than what's best for the party. And I don't know if that'll ever happen. They're probably not during my time there, but I think that that's something that has to enter the discussion.
Yeah, I've lost a little hope for the floor of the House of Commons to get where it should be. I'd like to hear your experience about whether, you know, that breaks down in committee a little. I mean, you sat on the Finance Committee for a few years, and that is full of some big personalities and characters. But when you get into that kind of in the weeds committee work, is there still a party whip coming in and being like, no, sorry, you're not allowed to budge on that? Or is it better in committee? That's an area, you know, we would never see, or I wouldn't ever follow.
Well, I think that might have been, you know, having the whip involved might have been something that was used quite a bit historically. I think some parties used the whip quite a bit. The Liberal Party doesn't necessarily have a strong enforcement in many of the areas. The requirement that we work with is to make sure that we all support what's in our platform. And that makes sense. I mean, if you don't support what's in the platform, why are you running? And we also want everybody to support what's in the budget and also to support the Constitution. And other than that, we got a lot of flexibility. We can vote against whatever legislation's coming up, or in committee, you can vote how you want. But it also makes a lot of sense for us to stay organized. So there's a lot of communications. I've had to talk to the whip a number of times because there was some days that I had other things happening and wouldn't be there for a vote. And I never had any problems. I've always had lots of good support from the whip's office and lots of flexibility. So, but at the same time, it's different. It's different from consensus government. The whole basis of consensus government is built on respect and trust and communication. I don't see a lot of the respect at the party politics level, and sometimes the communication is not the greatest too. So there's always comparisons that I make in my head as I'm watching things unfold and things happening, and I think I would pick consensus government anytime over party politics. But having said that, I'm not sure if consensus government could work at that level with that many people involved.
Yeah, consensus with a few hundred MPs is a much taller order.
Yeah, I think even at the territorial government level, sometimes it's a challenge to try to keep everybody focused on the issue, and sometimes the communication breaks down, or the trust and respect is not there, and things start to deteriorate, and consensus government needs those ingredients or it doesn't work.
Yeah, we most certainly have been having our challenges this assembly. One of the pieces of advice I got for consensus government is some of the best ways to get things done is, go out for dinner the night before a big vote and chat it through with the minister, and kind of I think it allows us the time to really, really build those relationships. And I'm curious, now that you've got to Ottawa, and I think you're about one of a dozen Indigenous MPs. I believe the only one who is from a small community or, went to residential school. It's a very small and a very urban kind of setting on the Hill. What's your advice to getting things done? If we send a new MP to Ottawa, or any new MP that goes to Ottawa, what's your kind of advice now that you've been there a while on how you get things done?
I think all people that are involved in politics enter politics with a vision of what they want to see happen. They want to see change, what they want to see new. And a lot of times the breakdown is, once they get there, they don't know how to get it done. They don't know what they should do. And you see a lot of people get elected, people that are very popular. They get involved and they yell and scream and kick up a bunch of dust and get a lot of media attention. And then the next election, they're gone. And then you kind of look and see, what have they accomplished? And most times it's not very much. So I think if you're going to get involved, You better have a plan on what you're going to accomplish while you're in politics. And you need to do your homework. There's too many. I think all of us can point to leaders, politicians that are entering politics or have a seat at the table that are not prepared to speak on certain issues. And if you're going to be at the table, you need to know the issues. You need to plan around the issue. You need to have a strategy. You need to be able to present the business case. And I like to think that politicians have to be, they have to be able to really treat people with respect and give people the confidence that they're on their side. I know for myself personally, that's something that I place a lot of importance on, that I also talk to my staff on a regular basis about treating everybody with respect. It doesn't matter who it is, doesn't matter their status in society. You treat them with respect and you listen to their concerns. One of the things that I was, one of the pieces of advice that was given to me when I first got involved in politics is that you really have to control your emotions. You can't be getting upset when somebody's telling you something and it doesn't fit with your opinion, or it doesn't fit on how you would think they should have done. You have to be a good listener, and you got to remember that people are coming to you because you have a problem, not because you're a nice guy, but because you're going to listen and you're going to try to work out their problem and find solutions. And that's not the easiest thing to do. I think as I watch a lot of people get involved at the federal level, sometimes people are getting involved at the federal for the wrong reasons. In my opinion, yeah. A lot of times I see young guys, young people, young men and women get involved because they want to increase their and better their position in society. They want to be in the news. They want to be famous. They want to be getting attention. And that's, for me, I don't know, maybe it's because of my age. It's not why you should be in politics. And I like to think that everybody's there to help others and to make our part of the world a better place to live. So I also expect that people that are going to be in MLAs or MPs need to have the ability to have good relationships with other governments. And for us, that means, for me, it means the GNBT, being able to have an open door approach with the ministers and the premier and the MLAs. And with the indigenous governments, I have good communications with most of the chiefs and Métis presidents. I talk to the mayors through their association of communities on a regular basis. And I try to attend all their meetings and try to attend the assemblies just to ensure that there's a connection there. And one piece of advice I would give to everybody that is in politics or is thinking of getting in politics, that you need to be able to find the right balance. You need to find the balance between work, your family, with other things in life. You need to be able to balance it with the travel that is required. And remember that people are counting on you. So those are some of the things that I've learned over the years, and some of the advice that I give to others, and some of the principles that I live my life and politics by. And it's served me pretty good up to now.
Yeah, well, and you certainly, in the Northwest Territories, there's a lot of balls to keep in the air, and there's no shortage of different levels of government to constantly kind of be keeping in check with. I sometimes have trouble with my couple thousand constituents, let alone, you know, trying to keep a pulse on the whole territory. I'd also be interested, you know, after, you know, a lifetime of doing this, how you have dealt with, you know, keeping that life balance when almost everywhere you go, I imagine, Michael, if you hop on a plane, someone's got a problem to bring to you, or anytime you show up at an assembly, you got, everyone's always bringing their issues to you. You know, I think your anonymity is long gone. I'm curious how you've dealt with that, kind of keeping that in check and that balance.
Some of these positions that you get elected to, I think people really need to recognize that it's not just a job; it's a lifestyle. It's something that you're gonna live, breathe, and share with everybody. You're living in a fishbowl, and everybody can see what you're doing. And it doesn't matter if you're with your children or your family or with a friend. People are gonna approach you because you're a public figure, and you have to learn that. And accept that. And I think I've accepted it a long time ago. I'm kind of in a different situation though, because it's been part of my life, my whole life.
Yeah.
You know, from the time I was working with my father, people were coming to him to deal with certain issues, to write a certain level or a problem with their pension or a problem with their income tax, and I was kind of part of that. And as I got older, people started coming to me because I was the band manager, because I was the mayor. And so I've been doing it since my teens. I was at the tribal council meetings when I was 17 years old, and people were talking to me then. And so it's something that I've accepted. My wife knows that if we're going to go to the grocery store, that she's got to give me a little bit of time, that because somebody's going to come and talk to me about something. But I accept it, and it's fortunate that I enjoy it. I enjoy talking to people. It's nothing more interesting for me than to sit down and listen to somebody's life story. Because everybody's got a very interesting story if you take the time to listen to it. Some of them are very tragic, some of them are funny, but everybody's got one. And I think it's probably going to be something that I'm going to live with even after I'm out of politics, because I don't think I'll ever stop working. Whether it's for the youth or for the community, it's something that I'll continue to do.
Yeah, I imagine your household will continue to be very busy, and you know, you'll still have people coming to you with their issues, helping them with income tax. Michael, I guess I'd like to kind of end with a bit of discussion, you know, of, you speak about, you know, young politicians, they have this vision and they struggle to implement it. And now that you've spent this lifetime in different roles in the territory, I'd like to kind of hear your let's call it your elevator pitch or your campaign door knocker of a future vision for the territory, or perhaps better phrased as, you know, what are some of the barriers we kind of have to overcome, or how? I'll let you take that question in whatever direction you want.
I got involved with politics many, many years ago, and I think I stayed with politics because I wanted to see change for the better. And a lot of times I've asked myself, what is the outcome that I'm looking for? And I always come back to the same conclusion is, and that is to have healthy people living in healthy communities. You know, that's very important because that'll give us the solution to many things. We need opportunity for our children, for our grandchildren. And that is the goal that I want to see happen. It's going to require many things, yeah. You know, to resolve and to get to that point. But for many people in the North, they're not living at the Canadian standard of living. And there's many reasons for it, of course, but a big one is if we go back and look at the treaties and the Métis scripts that were signed, they were signed so that everybody could coexist. And once they were signed, the governments of the day, the federal government and a little bit on the government North of Territory side, they kind of took over and made all the decisions. This country was developed, and this territory was developed with very little input from Indigenous people. And I think we need to change that. And Indigenous governments are really working hard to rebuild their nations and to find their place where they can be equal partners. And I think that's so important. So when we talk about advancing land claims and self-government, I think more importantly is to talk about reconstituting nations. We need to have people in our communities proud of who they are, proud of their history, able to speak the language. And if we don't change, that's not going to happen. And I think the country is realizing that. Canadians are starting to have their eyes opened up to what our history was and is with the Indigenous people. And we also have to be able to address some of the climate crisis issues. We got to get our communities off diesel. We got to be able to support clean and renewable energy. And we need, you know, quite a few projects to make that happen. And I think we've set the targets, but now we've got to get into the specifics and start putting it together. There's some programs that have moved ahead and are proving to be very successful. The Indigenous Guardians, for example. But we need to start putting some resilient infrastructure to mitigate the effects of natural disasters in place. And we need to do all kinds of things that are going to put us in a better position. And one of the most important things that has to happen is to build a sustainable economy. We need to be able to reduce some of the big gaps in infrastructure, reduce the gaps in service, and find ways to develop our natural resources and our mineral potential in a fashion that empowers our communities and our Indigenous people, but at the same time, it minimizes the environmental risk. And we got to make sure that all parts of our economy are healthy and doing well. You know, tourism sector has to be part of that, and there's other sectors that need to thrive and not only just survive. And there's lots we can do, and we also have to really start looking seriously at how the government of the Northwest Territories, the government of Canada and Indigenous governments in our part of the country can work together. Because as self-government governance is starting to happen and tribal councils are starting to become more organized, we're going to have a better system in place. And I think that's going to probably require some constitutional review of the situation and see how the government in Northwest Territories, the Legislative Assembly can change so that the Grand Chiefs have a more of a voice in the House, in the chambers, and maybe vice versa, how the members of legislative assembly could be more involved at tribal council levels. I think it's going to require a lot of discussion and look at a lot of things that may work and maybe some modeling. I certainly don't have the answer, but I see it starting to come. And some of those discussions are starting to happen.
Yeah, I think definitely for probably the first time in Canadian history, the actual reconciliation conversation is probably just starting. And then in the Northwest Territories, we are just starting to also have those conversations about what is the future of consensus government look like if we actually devolve the powers and as Indigenous nations kind of rebuild. I would like to hear your thoughts. You know, Michael, you've been involved in, you know, land claims in some form for, you know, 40 plus years through various different organizations and the various evolutions. And yet, you know, we still have, you know, half of our territory unsettled. And I would welcome your any insights you have on it's one thing that the conversations are happening, we're all agreeing, but getting that kind of implemented on the ground and the logistics of it seems to be a bit of a monumental task. I'd welcome your insight on, you know, what you view as the barriers, what you view as the actions either the federal government or the GNWT or Indigenous governments need to take.
I had an opportunity to take some very in-depth looks at what people are talking about, because I was selected in the 1990s, late 1990s, to sit in as a part of a team, the ministerial envoy, to talk about common ground between the different governments to see if there was enough to move forward so that you could work towards a goal at the end. And we traveled to a lot of communities, and I got to hear directly from a lot of the leaders in the Decho, and it was only the Decho that was involved at that time. And I heard loud and clear from all communities that they weren't looking for, you know, they didn't like the word land claim. We're not claiming any lands, is what everybody was saying. And this is not about money. This is about a way of life. And I heard so many people talk about the importance of having the language in place and keeping it strong and being able to pass on their traditions of hunting and fishing and gathering, and also to make sure that the stories don't die. You know, the history of the Dene people, of the Métis people, is passed on orally. And the stories are so important because they're not just short story about something. Every one of them is meant to teach somebody something. There's a lesson in it, or maybe it's just a way to keep people positive through humor. And it also it's a way of passing on who your family is, and that's really important. All those things are important, and it was something that I was able to bring to the federal government. When we talk as a party, as a as the Liberals, we wanted to make sure that we moved away from some of the things that were totally almost racist in the whole process of trying to sort out the land tenure, the governance model, all the different pieces of reconstituting a nation. You can't have an extinguishment clause.
Yeah,
you know, that was so insulting to everybody. Treaties and the script agreements are living documents. Things have to change, and they should be reviewed on a regular basis. And having a loan to sit down at a table to talk about how to co-manage your land or how to negotiate different parts of agreements was also very insulting. I don't think governments realized how awful that was. And I was so happy to see that our government got rid of those pieces, but we're still not quite there. We need to get rid of some of the policies that are tripping up Indigenous governments. We need a whole new approach. We need to, what the Prime Minister and Cabinet talked about was a recognition of rights framework where we can talk about reconstituting nations and talk about what do nations really need to be strong, to be healthy, and to provide good leadership and service to Indigenous people. And I think that's going to be very important. And in the process, we got to make sure that all levels of government have the resources to do a good job. And I don't see that at this point. It's something I'm encouraging our government to do. I see the Indigenous governments are very under-resourced. I see the federal government, in 2014, the Conservative government cut so many positions, negotiator positions and support staff at the federal level, that they're struggling to deal with the high numbers of negotiating tables. I know there's some other negotiators got about 50 files that they're working on. It means there's not enough time, not enough people to go around. So there's very little in terms of being able to commit enough time to make meaningful progress. So sometimes some of the negotiating tables that are not active, they kind of get pushed to the sidelines, and it's not fair. They need to be able to give the adequate time with enough resources to talk about issues that are concerning to everybody, and not have some bureaucrat in Ottawa design a policy that says this is the rules of the game. That's not going to work. We need to make it more accommodating, and I want to see some of our committees really engaged, start looking at what's happening. And it's difficult. None of the other provinces are in the same situation as the Northwest Territories. We have things that are happening here in Northwest Territories that other jurisdictions would love to have, but can't get. We have guaranteed seats for the Indigenous governments at the regulatory boards. The process requires Indigenous participation, 50% of the seats. They don't have that at provincial level. We have resource revenue sharing. It's not a big amount, but we have it. And it's not everybody's able to access it, but the precedent is set. and maybe that could be increased, but no other jurisdiction has that. And we have now a new self-government fiscal policy. That's great. It was designed by Indigenous governments along with the federal government, and everybody's happy with it. So we need to do more. We need the recognition of rights framework to be worked out so that the rules of the game are in place that everybody agrees is the way it should be. Because if it's forced down somebody's throat, they're not gonna accept it. It's the way it was historically, it can't happen like that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, once we have Indigenous government working shoulder to shoulder with the other governments, including the government of Northwest Territories, it'll also open the door for industry to start looking even more favorably in the North. Right now, industry wants certainty, and with outstanding negotiations, they can't see the certainty. We also have to look at the infrastructure side of things, because industry also wants to go into areas where it's cheaper for them, where the costs are not so high. And right now, our infrastructure needs, our deficit is so high that it's expensive to come to the North, especially if you make a significant fine. So, you know, those things we got to be mindful of.
Yeah, I think the kind of historic approach to self-government has been, okay, there's this big view of what a nation is, and you can fight to carve off pieces, and then we'll get the certainty through extinguishment clauses. And I see the shift happening both in the, as you mentioned, kind of the federal negotiating mandates and the financing that, no, it actually needs to be a building block. You take one section at a time and you agree to it, and there's none of this. Well, if you agree to that, then all this other things come off the table. But there's agreeing to that and then getting it into the culture and the, you know, mindsets of the negotiators and the bureaucracies is a whole other task. And I'd welcome your thoughts, Michael, after, you know, having both dealt with GNWT bureaucracy for years in this area and federal bureaucracy in years, any kind of insights you have into that disconnect that can happen at times between the political leaders and the bureaucracy, and whether either one of our bureaucracies is operating any better.
In my opinion, I think the challenge is to make sure everybody is educated on the situations that we face in the North. And I know at the federal level, a lot of the people in the bureaucracy know very little about the North. They know it's a cold, dark place, and there's not that many people there. And they know even less about the Indigenous people. And I think we have people in the government of Northwest Territories that are very familiar with the North. You know, most people that come here and decide to live here, along with the people that are already here, they're educated about what the North, the different parts of the North are like. But I think across the board, whether it's at the federal level or territorial level, there is people that don't want to see change, or they have a position in their head that they don't want to move away from. And that sometimes is very concerning, very, very upsetting to see somebody with their own agenda that puts up blocks, roadblocks when we want to make change. And it's the reason why things are not happening as fast as they could. You know, I'm very aware. I'm not blind. I'm aware at all levels of government, there's people that would rather see things stay the same or not see any change. And that includes the people in the the Liberal Party, there is people that have agendas that they want to put priority on, and so it's important that we remind them and educate them. And I think that is something that I do nonstop, and I always try to encourage other people to come to Ottawa, come to meet with ministers, come to meet with staff, come to meet with somebody in Ottawa, because it doesn't matter who you talk to. If you educate them, if you make them aware of our situation and some of the things that we work with and some of the challenges we're faced, it's a positive result. And I think in my 6 years that I've been there, going on seven, I've seen change. I've seen people learn about the North, and it makes me feel good, because when I first got there, I felt like there was very, very little attention being paid to the North. And it's going to require us being persistent. It's going to require us being able to meet on a regular basis. It can't just you make one comment and expect everybody to understand it. So that I feel is an important part of my job, but I think everybody else has a responsibility too.
Yeah, and I think you are recognized by people, you know, across party lines as kind of becoming an educator in this area, and most certainly I think the policy shifts are slowly emerging where the North is getting the recognition it needs in Ottawa. And you know, that's not an easy task at all, Michael. And I'd like to thank you for your work and your service. I think you are, you know, very much embody what public service looks like and what serving people looks like. And I just want to thank you for coming on the podcast, and thank you for all your good work as our MP.
And thank you for talking to me. I appreciate it. And hello to all your listeners that are going to be tuning into your podcast.
Well, that's a wrap on episode 9 of the On the Ledge podcast. Thank you for listening. As always, reach out to me with any comments, questions, concerns. I actually have scheduled our senator next, so we're going to have back-to-back Ottawa educational podcasts. You may have noticed, Happy New Year. I haven't released one of these for a few weeks. I didn't do it over the break, and then Omicron hit, and best laid intentions of podcasting kind of went out the door. But I think my new plan is to release these monthly, and I'll say that now so people can hold me somewhat accountable. Once a week, turns out, when you're trying to govern during a pandemic is not realistic. And I've also had a number of public hearings, which have taken other time, both of which were really productive. I encourage people to go check out. We had an Official Languages Act public hearing about some of the work that we are doing to review our Official Languages Act. And there was a lot of great speakers. In addition, the Standing Committee on Government Operations, of which I am newly chair of, had a public hearing on Indigenous recruitment and retention in the GNWT. And I was very thankful for all the people who came out and spoke at that. So I imagine once we get a little bit further in those pieces of work and we have some concrete suggestions, I will do some podcast episodes on them and invite some of the people who have spoke publicly at those hearings onto the podcast for further information. There were some really inspiring Indigenous language speakers we've heard from, and Michael himself being, you know, a champion of our Indigenous languages is a great fit. So thank you everyone for listening. As always, reach out anytime on the Ledge podcast. I'm your host, Ledge.